Good morning, all. Just one moment. Judge Rovner and I are pleased to have sitting with us this morning Judge Kendall, distinguished judge of the Northern District of Illinois, and we thank her for willingness to help us with our load.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. The first case for argument this morning is Laborers Local 236 versus Walker. Mr. Elke.
Judges Flom, Rovner, and Kendall. My name is Bruce Elke. I'm here with my colleague, Kathleen Lounsbury. We're here today on behalf of the Laborers Local 236, the AFSCME Union Local 60, and Jamie O'Brien. Jamie herself is present in the court, as well as Mr. O'Brien, who is the elected representative of the Laborers Local Union.
Just out of curiosity, forgive me for this, but who exactly is Jamie O'Brien? I mean, does she have some special stake in the case separate from Laborers Local?
Yes. She is one of the employees who's actually directly affected by the provisions of Act 10. She is an employee of the City of Madison.
Okay. But does she have a special stake that is separate?
Well, I think our view of it was that she was a personified or represents the individuals who are ultimately the people who are representing here.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Well, we're here today.
And hello, wherever you are. Okay.
I'm here.
Okay.
We're here today because we believe that the general municipal employees of Wisconsin have a fundamental right to associate and to engage in a voluntary, interactive process with their municipal employers in the hope that, and with the possibility that that process might result in a voluntary agreement with their employers regarding at least wages and conditions of employment. We believe that this is a fundamental right, that it is constitutionally protected by the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, and that Wisconsin Act 10, the provisions of Wisconsin Act 10 that relate to the employment relationship in their cumulative effect.
You know, I am very, why did you fail to cite our opinion in Wisconsin Education Association Council versus Walker in your opening brief? Because it would seem to foreclose your equal protection argument as to Act 10's payroll collection prohibitions.
Well, the first reason would be that we believe that case is distinguishable. In that case, as we understood it, the plaintiffs were arguing that there were certain particular provisions, individual provisions of Act 10 that violated the Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. And it was our understanding that that was argued in terms of the rational basis test for the testing of legislation. Our case, it's a little bit of the difference between the old, the forest or the trees. I mean, as we see it, as we understood it, the plaintiffs in that case were looking at particular trees and saying, oh, there's a tree there and there's a tree there, and these trees have problems. And well, we're stepping back and we're saying, look, it's not the individual trees here that are the issue. It's the forest. It's the cumulative effect of these provisions, any one of which in and of itself may well be okay. But when you put them all together, the effect is destructive of the right, the fundamental right that I just indicated, the right to associate for the purpose of engaging in an interactive process with the employers.
But if I thought that Wisconsin Education held that that portion of Act 10 that prohibited payroll deductions for union membership did not violate the First or 14th Amendments, and that the collective bargaining limitations also did not violate the 14th Amendment, would I be wrong?
Not necessarily. It's the accumulative effect of these provisions. I mean, any one of them standing by itself may well be okay. And again, it was our understanding that the challenge in the teacher's case was to the individual provisions. We're looking at the cumulative effect of it. I mean, when you put it all together, as we've argued in our brief, the provisions of Act 10 do several things. But can I back up here for a minute, Your Honor?
Of course, of course.
I mean, we're looking at the collective bargaining process as a whole, as a process, and our view and why we say we believe it's a fundamental right is this: we know that all citizens, whether we're talking about tavern keepers, restaurateurs, other business people, conservationists, open government advocates, or employees, have a fundamental right to petition their government regarding matters of mutual concern and interest. This process goes by different names. Sometimes it's called petitioning. Sometimes it's called we're addressing the government. Sometimes they talk about lobbying the government. I mean,
I don't think that is really the issue, though, that we have here. You're looking for the next step, which is we want to make sure that we're heard. We want to make sure that the government hears us.
This is right.
And, in fact, you even used that one language where you said we have a fundamental right, a strict scrutiny standard evaluation of this fundamental right to be heard, which I don't think any court has ever held, right?
I would disagree with you.
Okay. Which court has?
Well, what I was going to say, now I've got the white light on here.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understand you, Mr. Elke. Your position is you want 5 minutes to open and 10 minutes for rebuttal?
That was my thought.
No. It's all your time. It's all your time. But well, now that light is on, you're in the 10 minutes. So
I understand.
It just reduces your rebuttal time. That's all.
What I would like to bring to the court, point out to the court, is that with respect to this right that I'm talking about, this, whether you call it petitioning, lobbying, or whatever you call it, the United States Supreme Court in the Amalgamated Utility Workers case, that's cited in our brief, it's volume 309 of the United States Reports, page 261, citing NLRB versus Jones and Lawton Steel Corporation, made the point that the National Labor Relations Act did not create the right to bargain. The right to a self-organization or to bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing, that is a fundamental right that was not created by any statute. That's what the United States Supreme Court said. Since then, we know that federal courts, including the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, have recognized that public employees have a fundamental right to organize a union, to join a union, to participate in a union activity for the purpose of bargaining collectively. That's AFSCME versus Woodward and McLaughlin versus Telendis, which we've cited in our briefs.
But that goes back to, I'm sorry, may I ask a question since this time is short?
Sure.
That begs the question, though. If we don't disagree that you can join a union, as long as the employer isn't retaliating against the joining of the union, there is not a fundamental right to be heard once you have joined that union.
But our question then is two things. First of all, what we're objecting to in this case is that the state of Wisconsin in Act 10 has gone beyond just limiting collective bargaining. What they've done is they've said the employers cannot respond. They have placed a positive affirmative bar on collective bargaining, on petitioning, on lobbying by this particular group of people. They've barred them from doing so. And we're saying that is what creates the problem. This is why you have to look beyond any individual provision. You have to look at that bar coupled with the things that they did then with respect to the statutory collective bargaining. We're not saying that there's any right to a mandatory collective bargaining. There's no right to a statute that says there's a mutual reciprocal obligation on the part of the employers and the employees to bargain. We're not saying we have any particular right to that. That's a policy decision for the legislature. But we do say we have a right, a fundamental right, to negotiate to petition, to lobby, whatever you want to call it, to address our municipal employers.
Let me ask you a absolute bottom line question, and it's this. Your entire equal protection claim hinges on us concluding that Act 10 infringes on First Amendment rights. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
And I've reserved some time, I think.
Of course. Thank you, Mr. Elkin. Mr. Kilpatrick.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Kilpatrick. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, representing the defendants' appellees. In this case, there is not much in which we disagree, I don't think, after hearing opposing counsel. The state
I hope you also read the brief.
Yes.
Okay.
Also read the brief. And there is the state is not, contrary to what opposing counsel has said, banning or barring any petitioning rights or associational rights of the appellants. There is no ban or bar on employees joining a union, associating together, petitioning, assembling. There's nothing of the kind.
Well, you know, you claim in your brief that municipal employees remain, and I'm going to quote, free to choose whether or not to listen, solicit feedback, or discuss, which is pretty much what you just reiterated. But how do you reconcile that with Section 169's explicit command that, you know, no local governmental unit may collectively bargain with its employees? How do you reconcile those two ideas?
Well, first of all, the reference to that statute, I believe it's 660508, is that what you're referring to, Wisconsin statute? That is the portion of Act 10 and the MIRA portion of Act 10 that is a policy decision of the state that if there is going to be collective bargaining under the terms of the statute, which is the mutual obligation of the employer, the municipal employer, the government, to come to the table and sit down, forced to sit down with its employees, if that is going to happen, it's going to be within the confines of MIRA, and they're going to discuss wages for general employees. And only wages are going to be discussed, and only wages are going to be the subject of collective bargaining agreements. There is no prohibition of those same employees from petitioning their employers, from assembling, joining a union, and advocating for change, advocating for wages, higher wages, advocating for other conditions of employment. But there is no obligation, as we learned from Smith, Minnesota State Board, Hanover, there is no obligation for these employers to listen. This court in Hanover specifically said that there's First Amendment does not guarantee that association or speech will be effective. So there is no obligation whatsoever on the employer, public employer, to sit down at a table.
Well, then basically what you are telling someone, it seems to me, in essence, is that you may ask, but I will say no. I mean, that creates a situation where it's hardly worthwhile to ask.
That is what the Supreme Court has said. That is what this court has said, that there is no guarantee that the advocacy, the speech, will be listened to. There's no duty on the government to listen to the speech. And this legislation, this law, is not banning that speech. The First Amendment doesn't guarantee that a labor union's advocacy petitioning will be effective.
Assuming that we do apply the rational basis to this, what is the evidence in the record that supports that the unions would be more expensive or more costly? What was the rational basis for saying that these restrictions are not overly burdensome under the First Amendment?
Well, the one thing that is different this case from the first case, the one I'll call WEAC v. Walker, was that it was equal protection analysis theory, that there was a difference between public safety employees and general employees. And here we have a theory brought forth by the appellants that there's a different, that there's an equal protection violation of those individuals in municipal employment who are not represented by a collective bargaining agent versus those that are represented by a collective bargaining agent. So the difference is there's no public safety rationale here. And that was a lot of what WEAC talked about, the WEAC decision regarding public safety versus general.
Speaking of rationales, then, is Wisconsin's stated rationale here justifying its differential treatment of organized and non-organized employees the same rationale that was advanced in, as you call it, WEAC, and never do that in front of Judge Easterbrook, in Wisconsin Education Association Council versus Walker?
No, it's different, and it was stated in our brief, I believe, our brief on page 36. It goes to the budgetary impact. It's easier for municipalities to create a budget if they know that there is going to be this limitation on its collective representative employees versus those who aren't. And that was affirmed by the district court as a fulfilling rational basis.
But what was the support for that? Was that just the judge's inference or argument?
Yeah, it was based on argument that we had made in the motion for judgment on the pleadings. And under the rational basis test, as we asserted previously, is that there needs to be no evidence in the record to support rational basis. It can be based on what the state puts forth and what judges actually can decide.
I may have missed it, but was your answer yes or no a moment ago? In other words, is the rationale here the same rationale that was advanced in WEAC?
No, in WEAC.
So it isn't.
It's different. It's explained on 36 of our page 36 of our brief and in the district court decision that there's a difference. The rational basis behind treating employees who are represented by collective bargaining agents versus those who are non-represented is different than the rational basis in the Wisconsin Education Association.
So if I thought that WEAC directly foreclosed the plaintiff's equal protection argument as to Act 10's payroll collection prohibitions, I would be wrong.
You'd be correct, Your Honor, in the sense that rational basis is the level of scrutiny here. In this case, exactly as it was in Wisconsin Education Association, and all of the individual provisions were analyzed in the Wisconsin Education Association case. Here, the appellants have not made any individualized argument. They've made this cumulative argument, which, by the way, they still have not cited any legal support for the proposition that individually statutes that are constitutional somehow become unconstitutional when passed or gathered together. But getting back to the rational basis question, I believe that what Wisconsin Education Association does is says that this is a rational basis test, and in the briefs of the appellants, they have not argued against that. They have simply argued that there is strict scrutiny and that under strict scrutiny, the statute, the law fails. So they have not even responded to our rational basis argument.
Well, are you able to point to specific language in Section 169 that the reference to collective bargaining refers only to statutory collective bargaining? Because I don't think the statute says that explicitly, but maybe you do.
Well, it does make a reference in sub 3 to collective bargaining under Section 111.70 paren 4 paren MB 2, and that is what we call MERA, the Municipal Employment Relations Act. As you know, that's the subject of this challenge on Act 10. It's not entirely of Act 10, but just that portion of Act 10.
Well, is that your idea of an explicit reference to statutory, I mean, explicit only statutory?
Yes, yes, Your Honor. And also the argument fails for another reason, in the sense that there is no fundamental constitutional right to collective bargaining. There is collective bargaining as the statute has defined it. And in this case, it's the mutual obligation of the employer and the employee to get together. So the argument that there is some constitutional right to collective bargaining has been rejected time and time and again by this court and by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Do you think the right to assemble and petition implies a right to a dialogue?
No. No. Under Supreme Court precedent, it's been held, as I said in Smith, there is no duty of the government to listen. There is still the right in this under the law of Wisconsin for employees of municipalities to petition their government, to assemble, to associate together in a labor union, but there is no affirmative duty that the government listen to those petitions.
It sounds like Russia, doesn't it?
No, Your Honor, that's what the First Amendment allows. It allows petitioning. It doesn't mean that the petitioning is going to be effective.
Or even listened to.
That is correct. In the appellant's brief, they cite to a dissenting opinion and another opinion that doesn't stand for the proposition that we've put in our briefs, that there is simply no duty for the government to listen, to respond to petitions. It certainly may listen to these petitions, but it has no duty. There is no duty under the Constitution that it sit down at a bargaining table and bargain, negotiate over wages, conditions of employment, and the like with its employees. The only other thing I would like to say before I sit down is that the appellants have said that in our brief the state conceded to a position that it was somehow conceding that there was this mm-hmm. constitutional right to collectively bargain. And again, from our brief and from this presentation here, I believe that we've made it clear that we don't believe that there is such a right, and therefore there was no concession.
I know you mentioned that they didn't cite anything for this kind of aggregate of errors mm-hmm. or violations, and you mentioned that there's no area in constitutional law that would parallel, but we do have in other amendments an aggregate of errors. Maybe in the cruel and unusual punishment setting, you can have one issue may not be, but an aggregate of them may actually constitute a violation. The other one I was thinking was maybe in the grand jury, where one violation may not be sufficient, but an aggregate could be. Mm-hmm. So is there any support for an aggregate of violations in the First Amendment context?
Not that we're aware of, and actually we believe that this court's decision in Wisconsin Education Association and the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in Weiserza does address this argument. The argument seems to be that cumulatively these Act 10 provisions make it harder and more difficult and burdensome for the union to speak. And that argument was specifically rejected in the Weiserza decision by the Supreme Court and by this court in the First Amendment challenge to the payroll dues deductions provision, which was the same argument. These provisions make it more burdensome. This court has rejected that argument that the First Amendment does not require that labor unions be financially viable.
So once we take into consideration WEAC, all that would be left, I take it, in your view, would be plaintiff's challenges to the prohibitions on wage increases and collective bargaining.
I believe so. Part of the limitation for represent general employees mm-hmm. is the subject of wages. So only that is the subject of collective bargaining at this point. And that is what seems to be the appellants are talking about. But again, the state doesn't see how that in itself is a form of speech. There was the dues deductions argument in the Wisconsin Education Council case. That was recognized as a subsidy of speech, but frankly, we don't see the argument behind limitations on collective bargaining being speech. I see my time is up. I thank you for your time, and I simply ask that this court affirm the district court's order.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kilpatrick. Mr. Elke?
The one thing you're not going to find in the WEAC case is any reference to Section 169 of Act 10, and that's the provision that says, except as provided in sub 4, that's the mirror thing that's just been mentioned here, no local government unit may collectively bargain with employees. Period. That's what it says. And there is no reference to that. That section was not argued in the WEAC case. That section is the key to understanding Act 10, the Act 10 labor provisions. The Act 10 labor provisions are, if you look at them, and you look at them in their context, they are not just a series of, oh, here's a provision over here, let's throw this amendment in, and here's another provision over here, let's throw that amendment in, to amending the MIRA. Act 10, the Act 10 labor provisions are, in fact, a regulatory scheme. You have to look at, to understand their significance, you have to look at them as a whole. And that whole includes this provision in Section 169, which incidentally they happen to put off in another section of the statutes.
But what exactly is the basis of your argument for considering the cumulative effect of certain provisions of Act 10 under the First Amendment? I mean, are there individual provisions of Act 10 that you believe could be severed to preserve the Act's constitutionality?
We believe you have to look at it as an overall, as a program, as a scheme to regulate collective bargaining in the public sector in Wisconsin. And if you do that, what you'll see is, I mean, just think of this. Let's step back for a second and think about this. You've got first of all in this Section 169, you've got a prohibition that there shall be no collective bargaining agreement, none, except under the MIRA. Now you go to look at MIRA, and what does MIRA offer? What we point out is that what MIRA offers is you can bargain on a cost of living increase, but that's it. You have to run for re-election every year. You can only have a contract for a year at a time, and then the other things. So, I mean, what do you have there? I mean, what is left? What is left for the public employees, the general municipal employees, to what right do they have to negotiate with their employers, to lobby their employers, like everybody, all other citizen groups have? There's no such limitation on any other citizen group.
Let me ask you, the two payroll issues, the automatic union dues deduction and the fair share payment, how do you distinguish the Weissera case from the Supreme Court? Would not be unconstitutional.
Standing by themselves, they may be fine. At least they're not subject to constitutional challenge standing by themselves. If you look at them by themselves, they we're not arguing that they don't pass constitutional muster standing by themselves. What we're saying is when you look at that Section 169, that provision that says thou shalt not, there's no collective bargaining other than under the MIRA. Then you start looking at, well, what does MIRA give the employees? And, I mean, there's nothing there. I mean,
you can bargain for wages, right?
Pardon?
You can bargain for wages, is that correct?
Well, you can bargain for the cost of living increase, or less. You can bargain, basically you can bargain for, you know, assuming that cost of living increases actually mean something, that they're really tied to the cost of living, what you really are bargaining for is not to lose wages. That's what you can bargain for, Judge. That's it. That's it. That's all you can bargain for, whether or not you're going to lose wages. That's what they, that's what they've given, what the state of Wisconsin has given the general municipal employees as an alternative to the fundamental right, the common law fundamental right recognized in amalgamated whatever it was that I cited to you earlier and the other decisions of the United States Supreme Court that says the right to organize, to participate in a union and to bargain collectively is a fundamental right. What they've left, what the state of Wisconsin has left the general municipal employees with is they can bargain not to lose wages.
Before Wisconsin Act 10, what was the extent of organized employees' rights to compel, collective bargaining with, with the municipal and state employers? I mean, were there already statutory limits on collective bargaining in place?
Historically, Judge, what we had was, I got 5 minutes left. Historically,
no,
what we had
one.
Was.
That's all right. You may, as long as you have a dialogue with Judge Rogner, okay. You can continue, or with any.
Yeah,
judge.
You and I can talk for an hour.
Good. That would be a pleasure. but what we had historically was prior to 1971 or 1972. I mean, for, Labor's Local 236, for example, has been bargaining collectively with the city of Madison since like 1934. The AFSCME Local 60 has been around and been bargaining since 1934. AFSCME Local 60 since 1936. They've been bargaining. They've been making agreements. They've been sometimes the agreements were reduced to a written contract. Sometimes the agreements were reduced to an ordinance, an agreed upon ordinance. They've been bargaining. They were exercising that fundamental right. There was no statutory protection for collective bargaining. Starting in the late 1960s, Wisconsin began to enact certain protections on the right to bargain collectively. And in the 1971 or two, the state said, what we're going to do now is we're going to create a mandatory, we're going to create an obligation on the part of municipal employers not only to permit the collective bargaining, but we're going to place an obligation, a reciprocal obligation on both parties to negotiate in good faith, subject to various regulations. It's that regulation that was in effect that placed the reciprocal obligation on both the employer and the employees that was abolished entirely by Act 10. And then they added these other provisions, which we've talked about, and including, though, they threw into the pot, they barred the common law of collective bargaining.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Elkin.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement and the court